Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv Escana for immigration.com, the law office of Rajiv Escana, PC. Today, February 14th, 2013, this is a community call for the purposes of disseminating and sharing information only. We are not creating an attorney-client relationship here. Also, this call is being recorded, so please be mindful if you speak up, your voice will be recorded and made publicly available. I think it's a good idea for you to keep your identities confidential. You can make up a name if you ask a question. But if you want to share your name, that's your choice. That said, let me get started first with the questions that have been posted. First question is from Satyamurthy Kunju. They want to know, what is the supporting documentation for Form I-130? Mr. Kunju, I'll tell you this. The rule of thumb for all USCIS forms is quite simple. If you follow to the letter the instructions, the official instructions on the form itself, if you follow to the letter the official instructions on the form itself, you should not have any problem of a denial, outright denial. If there's anything missing, USCIS is required to send you a request for evidence. Okay. There are some limited circumstances under which they are not, but pretty much if you follow the instructions, you're quite safe. So my first recommendation to you, sir, is follow the instructions on the form. Now, we cannot help you fill the forms, and I have said this repeatedly, because if you look at the bottom of the form, it says who helped you prepare this form, and that person is supposed to sign the paperwork. Since we are not going to sign it, we don't represent you, I cannot really help you fill out the form. Then you haven't asked me to, in all fairness. But there's a limit to how far I can go. These questions that you posted, most of them I can answer. But the main answer that you needed is, what do I file with the I-130? The answer is just follow the instructions. You'll be fine. So if a brother or a sister sponsors their brother or a sister, the way it works is you only apply for the main beneficiary. You do not apply for the children or their spouse. All that gets done in later stages. So follow the instructions on Form I-130. Focus only on your brother and sister. Provide information only related to your brother and sister. Do we need the birth certificate of their kids? No. At this point, no. Marriage certificate, at this point, no. As far as I know, I haven't filled out one of these forms in years. There are people in our team who do that. I'm just speaking from my general knowledge of immigration laws and how these things work. It's kind of interesting. The way the immigration law is set up, and the reason I say it's interesting is this. There are two categories of people. Those who are bound to times, and those who are exempt from times. They are called immediate relatives. Who are they? Spouse of a U.S. citizen, okay? Under 18, child of a U.S. citizen, if I remember correctly. Yes, I think they're included. Yeah, they are included. And parents of a U.S. citizen. They are immediate relatives. When you apply for an immediate relative, their derivatives are not automatically included. So let's say if you sponsor your father, and he's got two kids under the age of 18, they're not automatically going to get their green card. Father has to apply for them separately after he gets his green card. But for non-immediate relatives, like brothers, like your brother or sister, when you apply for them, all their children under the age of 21, and for the details of that, you've got to go to something called CSPA, Child Status Protection Act, who's included, who's not. So for CSPA, will tell you who's included, but the bottom line is, you apply for the main person, your brother or sister, eventually their spouse and their under 21 children will automatically come with them. There is some process involved there. But you don't need your sibling's birth certificate, not birth certificate, your sibling's children's birth certificate. Your sibling's marriage certificate is not needed. Okay? And medicals and all that will happen much later, 13 years from now. I-864, I don't remember. I don't think you have to do it. Read the instructions on the form I-130. I think that too comes later. Okay. If the sponsor is not employed, do we provide an 864A? What happens is you can provide an affidavit of support from a co-sponsor, and they can be anybody. They can be a family member. They can be a friend. Okay? I hope that that makes it simpler for you. Next question is from another migrant, I-485-RFE. They were an ex-TVU student. They were only out of status for 10 days. I remember reading their paperwork, their question from before. So came back on H-4, a previous H-4 visa, got new I-94. Okay. The only thing I can think of in your situation, government can take an exception to your reentry on H-4. You said you've sent me the RFE docs for my review. I haven't found them. I mean, what happens is I forward the email in our team to whoever needs to read those things, probably Anna, to respond back to people. So I don't have your. I hope you're on the phone. You can tell me a little bit more about the RFE. But the only thing they can take an exception is to the reentry on the H-4. The law is, if somebody has been out of status for even one day, which the government can claim 10 days you were out of status, then the visas on your passport are automatically canceled. Government has never really made a big issue of this law, even though it exists on the books, but it does exist on the books. Other than that, I don't see any problem. If you are on the phone, please tell me what your exact RFE says. I'll come to you as soon as I'm done answering the questions. It shouldn't be long, okay? So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Hopefully you're here. Next question is H-1 visa NB. What happened in their paperwork was their I-129 got approved, but they found that there was a problem about the date passport was issued and the date passport expired. See, the problem is you cannot change anything on the petition after it has been approved unless it is government error. The only way you can change it is to refile the H-1, okay, as far as I know. Well, the good news is because you were on premium processing, you can double-check with just an email to the premium processing supervisor or the premium processing people. You can even call them and say, we've got this problem. What do you want us to do? I do not think they can do anything about it. I think they will ask you to refile. Now, is this a big problem that your petition had two dates wrong, the date passport was issued and the date passport expired? Look, in this environment, anything can be a problem, okay? I don't think, if you had asked me this question 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I would have said no big deal. But now, the smallest problem could cause you delays. Ultimately, you'll be okay. It's not like you're not going to be able to allow to enter USA, but they can definitely harass you. And going for visa stamping could be a problem because they can ask, consulates can ask questions there. What you should do is probably one thing which is very important. You should send an email to the U.S. consulate saying, I've discovered this error on my paperwork. What do you want me to do? And they're pretty good about responding these days. Okay, I must congratulate the State Department. They are responding to emails, at least in my experience, fairly well. Okay. You can also have your lawyer post to, what is it called, VisaNet? No, let me think about the name. There is actually a mailing list for lawyers for State Department matters. It's only for lawyers. It is not for, it skipped my mind the exact name, something net, VisaNet. We do it. I mean, occasionally we do send a message to that list. And we get a response from the State Department visa office, which is the headquarters, and they're in charge of all the consulates all over the country. So tell your lawyers to send a message to that list as well, okay? I am not convinced that just calling it a typo is enough. I disagree because in this environment, it is just not a good idea to take a chance, okay? So send an email to the consulate as well as have your lawyers post to the net, that is the mailing list that we mailing list that we have for a visa office in Washington D.C. What is that called? My God, it bugs the heck out of me. I can't remember it. Visa. It's a State Department mailing list. Okay, we do post to it, and we've been frankly quite lucky in getting responses so far. But the consulates will respond to you. Ask them. You know, I've got this error in my I-129. What do you want me to do? Are you going to issue me a visa? Are you going to create a problem about this? Okay. Next question is from Kavita, who wants to know EAD renewal, travel, and job change. Okay. She says, thank you. You're very welcome, Kavita ji. It's my pleasure to do this. I'm on H-1 from 2004, which is expiring in September 2014. So you've got the EAD-AP cards. You are the main applicant. Husband is derivative. He's in India right now. Or he is in India from March 2012. Will continue there for a long time because of dad's health. He'll be coming to U.S. once in a while, but he cannot stay more than 1 or 2 weeks. Can we apply for EAD-EAP extension while my husband is out of the country? No. How long can I stay out of the country in this situation? Is it okay to go to India for 3 to 5 months? Yes, as long as you have either that job, which must be permanent, or a similar job under AC-21 available to you when you come back. Okay? So that's not a problem. Going to India is not a problem. But it's got to be obvious that your permanent job, whichever that job is, whether the job that sponsored you or an AC-21 type job, is available to you when you come back. Okay? If you adopt a baby in India, how can we bring the baby? Well, the way it works is, if you're not a U.S. citizen, if you're an immigrant or a non-immigrant visa holder, you've got to adopt the child and keep them in personal custody for 2 years in India. Only then you can bring them as your child. Okay? So if I start using EAD, if you adopt a baby from India, how can you bring the baby to USA? Can we update the I-485 application? Yes. In fact, you know, the way it works is, now let me just take a minute here. Let's say somebody's pregnant while their green card is going on. They are in India, let's say. And 3 days before their interview for green card, they deliver a baby. Can the baby come with them? The answer is yes. Because if the baby was born at the time you got your green card stamping done, the baby is entitled to come with you, derivative status. By the way, there's also another rule that if the child is under 2 years of age and they were born after the visa stamping and this is their first trip to USA, they can come to USA with you. So there's many different ways of doing it. Yours is a little bit more complicated because you're going to be in physical custody of the child. There's a whole body of laws that governs that custody issue. Okay? If I start using EAD, how can we bring the child? You're thinking about H-4. And the answer is what I just gave you. You're not going to be able to bring the child anyway until you've had physical custody for 2 years. Then there are two questions from Deep Shankar and Priya, and they are both the same idea. I guess you may be even the same people. One is Priya, maybe Deep Shankar is writing about his wife, I'm not sure. Well, but the questions are very similar. So the employer wants to know, the employee wants to know, can my employer make me pay the H-1B fees after resignation? What if I had signed something with them that I will pay? This is an extremely complicated area of the law. Okay. First thing you probably want to do is you probably want to go to immigration.com and about us. So if you go to immigration.com and you, let's see, go to about us, I don't think you can see that here. Right on top, very top bar, there is about us. Okay? And there should be a page for articles that I have written. So you click here, Rajiv's articles. the latest article I wrote is this one, which is liquidated damages clauses in H-1B visa holders' employment contracts. The point I made here is that some of these attempted recoveries are actually illegal. Like I said, there's a whole lot, body of laws involved here as well. But the beginning is that you should take a look at this article. It's a long article, several pages. Actually, even on my LinkedIn page, I have that. If you go to my LinkedIn page, let me see if I can. If you go to my LinkedIn page, I hope I haven't logged in. Yes. And you go to the profile, you will see a list of articles that I have written. And the very top one is liquidated damages clauses in H-1B visa holders' employments right there. Okay? So you can definitely take a look at that article. The point is, it's not a simple determination what can be recovered and what cannot be recovered. But there are H-1B fees recovery is almost always illegal. They can recover other things maybe. You know, if you broke something, or if you have a, you know, if you caused a problem in the relationship with the client, they can sue you for other things. But H-1 fees is almost always not recoverable. So yes, if you file a complaint with the Department of Labor, your employers can be in a lot of trouble. Okay, so for both of you, Deep Shankarji and Priyaji, that's the answer. You should go ahead and report. Next question is Imi Ravs. Worked from a, okay, let me try to remember. I've read all these questions this morning. I may have skipped. I've kind of forgotten some of the issues. Okay, it says, worked in the U.S. for employer A from 2007 through 2011. Got an I-140 approval. In 2011, company A got downsized. Had to move to company B. Got an H-1B to 2014. Based upon company A's I-140. Traveled to India on emergency in Feb 2012. Visa got denied. 214B, which is still pending. 214B for an H-1. Okay, that doesn't make any sense to me. Anyhow, company B applied for my green card, filed for I-140 based upon the earlier I-140, which got approved in December 2012. As per your valuable suggestion, I guess my valuable suggestions, I had opted for consular processing. On January 28th, he's got an immigrant visa application processing fee invoice from NVC. So his question is, isn't it too early for NVC to be asking me for fees? You know what? NVC responds to emails very, very nicely. You can send them an email. And from what I remember of the process, the priority dates do not have to be current for NVC to be sending you a fees bill. We've received them. Is it an error? I don't think so, but you can double check with the NVC. And usually there's a deadline of 1 year from when they send the paperwork for you to fill and send it back. Okay. That was one of your questions. Are a green card via CP costs higher than AOSSR? I have no idea. Some of these very low-to-the-ground details I don't bother with because there are other people in the office who do them. My head is a little small. I can only do the law. So kind of don't remember all these nitty-gritty details of the procedure. But I can, you know, if you can't find it out, I can find it out for you if you send me an email through the Contact Us form on our website. Okay? I'm trying to go to U.S. after applying for 2013 H-1B cap. You may even be cap exempt, actually. Don't know when you left and how long you've been. Okay, assuming you're subject to the cap, what are the options to continue the green card? You can always change back to AOS if you want. You can convert back to AOS. That's quite easy. Okay. So what would I do if I were you? If I got an H-1 and came to USA, I think I would file for an AOS. I would file for an adjustment of status. Okay. V3S has some nice words to say about what we do and some blessings for us. Thank you so much. Okay, so I'm on H-1B for company A since April 2010. EB-3 PERM approved with company A for the same employer. Okay. I also have an EB-3 I-140 approved. Good. H-1B extension is due. max out date for H1 is March 2014. Job is unstable. So here are the questions. If I transfer to company B, can I use the approved I-140 of company A to get a 3-year extension? Of course, no problem. How will it impact my situation for the H1 transfer if company A decides to revoke? If they revoke, I don't know how you can get an extension of the H1. If they revoke it after you get your extension, I don't think there's a problem. With company B, can I use PD for my EB3 filing even if company A decides to revoke my I-140? Yes. The only time you lose your priority date is if USCIS revokes the I-140 for fraud. A company's revocation or withdrawal of their I-140 does not affect you. Okay, once the I-140 is approved, the priority date is yours to keep. In the event company A does not lay me off, is there a certain period I should stick with them before I do an H1? This is after an I-140 approval. No, there is no requirement that you've got to stay with them after I-140 approval a certain number of days in order for you to carry your priority date forward. There is no such requirement. Okay. Next question is Sunil R. Kimi. Two cases. Case one, I am with company A, beyond 6 years of H-1B and I-140 approved 3 years ago. Priority date is 2008 and an EB3. You got a technical diploma, which is 3 years, and an engineering degree, which is another 3 years. That, sir, is a very common pattern, because typically what you'll have is you'll have a polytechnic diploma of 3 years, and then you get a degree in mechanical engineering or electrical engineering, and the university has given you 1 year off for having that diploma. Your degree is still a four-year degree, but it was done in 3 years because they give you 1 year off. We've had this situation many, many times, and we have always gotten EB2s where the employee also had 5 years of experience after their engineering degree. So, yeah, USCIS is familiar with this pattern. They will probably send you an RFE, but you can do an EB2. Okay, we've never had a problem ultimately getting EB2 done, as long as we can prove this is really a four-year degree, and I got 1 year off because I have a three-year diploma. My questions are, can I change to company B and refile EB2? I think so, and you can retain your priority date, as I've said so many times. If I change to company B, can I expect to have the new H-1B with company B for 3 years? You should. If I move to company B and don't like working there, can I switch to company C? Sure. If three can be done, I would like to know if there's any time limit restriction, wait for I-140 approval. I just answered that question, no. If I leave company A and they file for I-140 revocation, does that have any impact? Only if your H-1 is not approved. If H-1 is approved, after that, the revocation does not have any impact. Yes, you will not be able to get further H-1 extensions based upon that I-140, but then you get started with a new green card. Okay? So next question is case number two. My H-1B and my wife's H-4 is expiring this year in May. Extension just applied. I just realized that on form I-539, there was a mistake. My wife's passport valid date was 2010, but since it was renewed, it's now valid up to 2020. There was an oversight from the attorney. What needs to be done? Because the case is still pending, definitely a quick letter along with an amended form would be a good idea. Letter along with an amended form. Let's see if that works for you. Visitor's visa. P. Prem Chand wants to know, mom is here. She's come here several times. This is the first time we are thinking of extending her visa, her stay in USA. Is that going to have a negative impact on her extension of the visa because that's expiring in May 2013? Difficult to say. Okay. The good news is because she has been here 5-6 times and you've never applied for an extension, or you've applied for an extension once before, it's difficult to say. I would avoid doing an extension at this point of time because you're so close to getting a visa stamp. I would avoid it. Okay. So then next question is Pranavi 0425, H-1 cap exemption. She's got a friend who's got H-1B approval, got a 221G, it was not responded. So she's got an H-1 approval, but she never got a visa. Question is she subject to the cap? I don't know. Okay, worth trying. Worth trying. See if she's indeed quota exempt. That's what I would do. I would try. Can she enter on B1, B2, and then once she enters on B1, B2, apply for H-1B? Never a good idea. Going from B1, B2 to any other long-term visa is almost uniformly a bad idea, because the consulates take the position that when you got the B1, B2 from us, you told us you were going to go in for a very limited period of time, and then you converted to a long-term visa like an H-1. Obviously, you lied. So it's almost uniformly a bad idea. I don't like people converting from B to H visa. As far as quota exemption is concerned, I haven't been able to find anything definitive on this issue. If anybody else is aware, please let me know. But I don't think there's anything definitive out there. I always try it. Okay. Last question for the day. Narik72 wants to know this. So, currently on an H-1B. Now, if two companies apply for my H-1, is that going to be a problem? Not at all. You see, the only restriction is this. Multiple simultaneous H-1B. Only one restriction. If you are subject to the cap, first of all, you are not subject to the cap. So same employer can file 10 cases for you. 10 different employers can file 10 cases for you. No problem. The only restriction against simultaneous application is if you are subject to the quota and the same employer is trying to file more than one case for you. Okay? Because the idea is that way you are maximizing your chances for the lottery. But if even under quota, if different employers apply for you, it's not a problem. Bear one thing in mind, though. If you're signing any contracts with these companies, that can expose you to issues, contract issues, but nothing to do with immigration law. Okay, well, let's see if we can answer some of the follow-up questions. Folks, anyone has any follow-up question, please press 5-star on your phone. 5-star. One, two, three questions. Okay, let's begin in the order people logged in. First is from area code 858. Go ahead, sir, ma'am.
Hey, hi. I'm V3S.
One second, please. Can you go again?
Yeah, sure. I'm V3S. Basically, I have a quick follow-up question. In fact, I have two. So I heard that, you know, once I'm in the process of H-1 transfer, so my company A shouldn't revoke my 140. Is that correct?
Once you're in the process, if the H-1 is approved, then it doesn't matter.
Correct. So until my H-1 transfer is approved, I'm hoping that my company doesn't revoke, my company A doesn't revoke. That's the thing, right?
Thing. That's a good hope, and you need that, yes.
Okay, cool. Then I have a quick follow-up question to this. Now, let's say in the event my company A does revoke, knowing that, you know, I'm actually looking out for, you know, options, and then they know, and they revoke the 140. So how long it takes it to happen in that sense, like, you know, USCIS?
Here's the problem. Let's say I'm your employer and I want to revoke your case.
Mm-hmm.
I send out a letter today. USCIS will probably act on it 3 months down the line, okay, or four months. But normally, the revocation goes retroactively to the date I asked for it.
Okay.
So that can create a very silly situation, very strange situation. Let's say today I asked for revocation. 5 days later, your H-1 got approved. Then three, 4 months later, my revocation got approved. It goes back to a time prior to your H-1 approval. So can the government go after your H-1? Yes, I think so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay. So it's a very odd situation, but they don't usually do that. Once the H-1 is approved, they don't usually go back and try to revoke your H-1. One more thing I want to point out to you. It's a very odd situation. I've seen this happen twice at least. Not only does the government revoke it from the date I made the request, they can revoke it from the date I asked from in the letter. So let's say I send the letter out today and I said, please revoke it effective July 1st, 2012. They probably will revoke it back to 2012. Some of these people don't understand the law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So, all in all, here is how I would handle it if I were you. I would ask the new company to start my H1, file it premium processing, and join them only after it gets approved.
Right, and then inform the company once I got the approval.
Yes, I'm leaving. Goodbye.
Okay.
Okay.
So at that point of time, like, you know, my I-140, even though they revoke, it doesn't matter. I can still use the priority date.
You're in a legally very safe position from what I can tell.
Okay. Okay, but that doesn't impact my priority date as well, right?
No, it does not.
Okay, cool. I got it. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Area code 484. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Rajuji. This is another migrant.
Yes, sir.
Regarding 485 RFE.
Yeah, what is the 485 RFE? What are they asking you?
They're asking for, like, as I remember, like, we never submitted previous I-94 or anything. Maybe that time valid I-94 we submitted along with 485. They're asking for, like, a visa or any federal government issued document, photo ID document. Other one is status. Like, I need to prove my status. It's like,
okay.
I'm asking.
Hang on one second. If I were representing you in that I-485 RFC, okay, my first answer to the government would be, let's say, the only time period that matters is the time period between 27th January 2011 and now. That was the last time you entered USA, right?
Actually, this is behalf of my wife. Okay, my wife, actually, TVU closed on Jan 19th.
Wait. I understand when TVU closed down. Let me ask you a question. Let's do
okay.
A timeline here. When was the I-485 filed?
It was on March 2nd week of 2012, last year.
Okay. Counting back from March 2012, when was the last time she entered USA?
It's in July 21st or 22nd of 2011. At we went to Canada and we came back. We got new I-94.
You came back on H-4, right?
Yes.
So the only time period USCIS should be looking at is between July 2011 and March 2012 when the I-485 was filed. Okay? That's what I would argue. I would say the only time period under Section 245K as in kite, the only time period that counts is the time between my last entry into USA and the time I filed the 485. As long as I have not been out of status for more than 180 days, during that time, I'm okay. Okay? Now, of course, government can take the position that you should not use your H-4 visa because you were out of status for 8 or 10 days. But that's a very long shot. Let me tell you this.
Okay.
I think if you make the 245K argument, you'll be fine. Worst case scenario, the very worst case scenario, your wife will have to step outside USA one more time. Are you still on H-1?
She is using EAD, so I am on EAD.
No. Her using EAD does not convert you to EAD.
Okay, H1, actually. It is valid 2014. My wife's
worst
is valid till 2015.
The worst case scenario is she goes to Canada, gets her H4 visa stamping, comes back again, and you apply for her I-485 once the priority date is correct. That's the worst case scenario. Personally, I don't think that's going to happen. I think you'll be able to get your I-485 approved with a 245K argument.
Okay. Actually, one more follow-up question. After TVU closed, actually, she entered with the same visa twice. Like, once she went to India and came back in February 2011, and in 2011, July, we went to Canada and came back. During 2011...
H-4 visa, right?
Yes, with the same visa. Actually, I don't know...
I think that 45K argument is going to work just fine for you.
Okay. Other one, quick question, sir. It's like the main reason actually, we recently applied for renewal of EAD. I got my EAD renewal for 2 years. And at the same time period, she got RFE for 485.
Okay.
Is there any relevance? Like, we are still waiting for her.
I think it's coincidence. I think it's coincidence. Your cases got assigned to a adjudications officer around the same time. But you're applying for EAD, her getting RFE, I don't see any connection.
Actually, we are still waiting for our EAD to renewal, and mine, I got my card.
I still don't see any connection.
Okay. Other one is actually, meanwhile, actually, we need to renew our passport for, like, expiring. Can we apply parallelly just answering this question, or just we need to send this passport to Indian Embassy?
You can apply parallelly. The one has nothing to do with the other. Go ahead.
Okay. Can I ask two more small questions?
Well, I have one more person waiting. If you make it really quick, yes.
Okay. Actually, if EAD, we did not receive in time EAD in next 2 months, she supposed to stop working?
Yes. No EAD, no work.
Okay. And final question is like, as I read, like maybe in previous forums or just in previous conversation with you, just what it is, like visa revalidation? It is
automatic,
not going to the
case. Visa validation. Automatic,
yes.
Visa revalidation. Is that what you're talking about?
Was she not into that case? Like she was like went to India and came back.
I don't have time to explain the whole thing to you, but that has absolutely no effect on her. I don't see any application of AVRES.
Okay. 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 Thank you, sir.
Bye bye.
Thanks, sir. Thank
you. Bye. Area code 318. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajivji. This is Kavita, and this is related to the same question I asked. You said no for the first question, so I want to understand whether you're saying that we cannot apply for the extension or we cannot use the AP to enter.
One second. I don't remember your question, so I have to...
Okay, my husband is in India, and...
I have it in front of me. One second. Let me read, please.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on H1 expiring September 2014. Oh, yeah, okay, I got it. I remember now. So what are your first question was, can we apply for EADAP extension while it's out of the country? No, you cannot.
We cannot apply. Basically, the thing is I don't know what to do because my husband is in India and he cannot come to US now and it's expiring. So there was no other option, so I just applied for EAD and AP. He sent the documents from India, and then I applied because either we can use it or we cannot use it. But he cannot come to US, so I had no other option.
Avitaji, here is what you can do. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, somebody on H4, if they have a visa stamp, they can stay outside US.
Yeah, he has a visa stamp on H4.
When is that expiring?
That is expiring next year.
So he can stay outside till next year, okay? As long as you keep your H1 alive.
Okay. But he cannot apply for EAD. I mean, EAD we cannot use, I know, but I thought probably he can use after H4 expires or something like for the next trip. So you are saying it's not, it won't be even valid if I get a EAD for him.
You cannot apply for an EAD or an AP when he's outside US.
Okay. Is it okay if he comes here, he applies, and then he leaves before getting approval?
That is also, we have been looking at this issue for a few weeks now, actually, in different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
There is no clear answer to this question.
Yeah, because in the application itself, it clearly says that you cannot leave the country after you applying. So that's the reason I thought that's a valid thing.
We have checked with CBP, and we've gotten two different answers from two different people. So, best to assume that if you travel when your EAD is pending, you cannot use it.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is the correct answer.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people out there who are looking into this issue. If you have been able to find something and think that you have better information than I do, please send it to me also. I would appreciate it. But in my mind, both AP and EAD should not be used if you traveled while they were pregnant. Now,
okay.
Here's an interesting question, and I think this might be okay. What if my, see, right now you get a two-in-one card, but what if there were two separate documents, and I've got my EAD pending, but my AP is still valid, I travel. I think that's okay. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what is the difference, but I've never been able to find a good answer to this question. Can I travel on my existing AP and still use an EAD and API file while I was traveling? By the way, interestingly, this is the answer I got from CBP about 5 or 6 weeks ago. I don't know how far this is true because I have nothing in writing, just the word of an officer. They said, if you travel on an existing advance parole and come back within the validity of that advance parole, the fact that your EAD and AP were pending would have no problem. So you can use those EAD and AP if you traveled on an existing AP and came back within its lifetime. However, you cannot use the approved AP, the AP that was approved in your absence, to re-enter U.S. So let's say my AP is expiring in July. I apply for EAD AP and I come back in June. It looks like what CBP is saying is that I can use both the EAD and AP. However, if I come back after July, even though my second AP that I filed is approved, let's say in June, I can't use that. I can't have one of my friends send me that new AP and use that to enter U.S.
Yeah.
I don't know what is the theory behind this. I don't know what they told me is right. I just like not to take a risk in these cases. If possible, keep your EAD, AP alive by applying for them here and receiving them before you go.
Okay.
Okay.
And one more thing, one more question actually related to the same thing. So I'm right now consulting. So can I go for a long time to India and come back? My H-1 will be valid, but he won't revoke my H-1. But I won't be paid. I won't have pay stubs. So will that be okay?
I think it's okay because, and you should give something in writing to the company also, saying that
okay.
You know, I need. Basically, you are going because there is a family emergency or family. Problem, a disease in the family. You have to go to
mm-hmm.
care of. You're not going because you don't have a project or something. Your current project is ending, so you can leave. It's not because you don't have a project. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you are leaving because of a personal necessity. I think that still keeps your H-1 active.
Okay. And since H-1 is active, even though I don't have pay stubs, it's not a problem for my GC or anything.
I think it's okay. It's sort of like if you are in USA, you are allowed to take advantage of something called FMLA, Family Something Leave Act. Family. Blah, blah, blah. So FMLA allows you to take leave and not be, penalized for it. I think it should be okay for a reasonable period of time as long as that personal emergency exists. I recently had a case in which somebody had been out of work for 2 years. On H-1, because she was sick, she was hospitalized several times, she's still struggling with the disease. We were able to get her H-4 within USA, even though she had not worked for 2 years. Okay? We explained to US that it's not because she was out partying, it's because she really had a problem. So the answer, it's a very similar situation. The answer is, I think we should be able to convince the government why you left was simply because of the personal reason you had. And that should not invalidate your H-1, especially because the employer is leaving the job open for you.
Okay. And this won't affect my GC process, right?
But it's not foolproof, Kavitaji. They can actually decline to accept that and say, no, you don't have an H-1 any longer. But does that affect your green card process, which is your next question? I don't think so. As long as the permanent job is still open, you can convert your 485 to consular processing and come through consular processing.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Anyone has any question, press 5-star. Any question, posted or not. 5-star. Excellent. I think we are done. I will see you folks again in 2 weeks. Thank you for being here, guys. Oh, one more question. I guess I'll take that. I stopped recording.